Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Lotlin, and with me today is Aaron Peck. Aaron is the North American President and Managing Director for the global market research consultancy, Metrics Lab. While the majority of people I've interviewed on this podcast are leaders in data, analytics, or data science, this time we ring the changes by talking with the leader of a market research agency. Aaron Peck has been in the research business for nearly 25 years and currently serves as that leader of Metrics Lab for North America, a leadership responsibility that I'm sure we'll explore further. So I'm delighted to be back thinking about market research again. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here today and have the opportunity to dialogue with you a bit.
Great. Thank you. Good to have you as a guest, too. I must say you're adding to our growing number of guests from across the pond as well. It's almost heading toward a balance between US and British guests. Just for our listeners, where do you join us from today?
I am based in Baltimore, Maryland.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'm still coming from Newport, South Wales, everybody. So there's our distance. I'm delighted, I said, to be back with this focus. We last considered customer insight or market research leaders when I talked to Elspeth Gotellenberg from Informa Markets back in episode 5. So I feel like it's been too long, given I strongly believe in the continued relevance of market research for customer insight and for analytics leaders as well. So I'm sure that's a topic we're going to explore. To get us started, though, you may well know, Aaron, I think every guest I've had on this podcast, I ask them at the beginning to share their career story, their backstory, if you like, so we know where they're coming from. Could you tell us a bit about your background and your career in market research firms?
Yeah, sure, Paul. And you touched on the fact that I've been in the business for about 25 years. Mm. In fact, I got my start in market research while I was still at college, my senior year, and being pretty broke and needing to put some things on the resume, I thought, boy, an internship would be pertinent right now. Mm. And through that, I found market research. So I did an internship with a global market research firm. I was working out of their cafeteria, as lowly interns do sometimes. and I found I enjoyed it so much so that the firm offered me a full-time position as I wrapped up my studies at school. And the rest is history. Over that 25-year span, I've held positions, as you might imagine, in junior analysts through research analysts and through the research manager, then into the account management side of the business, through to, group account management director, and then getting into more mid and senior level corporate management. And now I find myself, in that executive management slot. So I've really run the gamut in all those functions. It's funny, though, I entered college thinking I would get a degree in computer science. Okay. I found very quickly, though, that I had a passion for, the human sciences, if you like. And so my degree ended up being psychology with minors in anthropology and communications. And as I look back, I think those skills have served quite well in this business.
I bet. Yeah, it sounds in some ways like you were ahead of your time in the way that many find, and I speak for myself as much as anyone else, I think, find they develop. I think a lot of us, like me, who began with a very mathematical or scientific kind of focus and interest, as you age, shall we say, the interest in the humanities, the fascination with psychology, I think grows naturally. So well done in being ahead of that curve and spotting it would fascinate you for the long term. I was going to ask, actually, interesting that you've got that grounding in the actual research, and then, as you say, have done your time kind of on the business development or sales side, and then into the management and now executive leadership of the company. I guess from outside, it's easier for client-side people to think, salespeople are just salespeople, and they'll sell anything. Do they really understand the market research? Did it make a difference for you in your career that you really knew the product, if you like? You understood research. You weren't just selling baked beans, to use the classic symbolism.
Yeah, that's a good question. The short answer is absolutely it matters. In my view of the business these days, there's a need for both of those skill sets. The Swiss Army knife, if you will, of a client handler is someone, in my view, who has a research background, more importantly, understands how research, when fit for purpose, addresses a business need and can be applied to business success. At the same time, being a great researcher doesn't necessarily mean you can drive a sales process, because there are things about that that are distinctly different. And sometimes the middle ground is, well, hey, you're just so darn good at delivering the research value, right, that the business grows organically. And I love when that happens, but I do think a blending of those skills are very important. And frankly, I think training on sales acumen is the easier piece. Establishing research expertise and building a body of knowledge and having a perspective and a point of view for clients, that's grown over the life of your career, right? So yeah. I'd rather find that type of talent and then build upon it with sales acumen. But no doubt, both are important.
Yeah, that's good. Good point, Evan. Gosh, you're such a different background and focus to talk to. I'm going to relish this. That whole aspect of relevance to the business and being able to spot the research that solves a business problem, I think, as you put it, how do you stay close to that? Because I hear the benefit of having a good grounding in market research, but I guess that hints at also understanding the commercial challenges of your clients. How do you develop that side so that even in an agency, you've got that kind of commercial acumen?
Yeah, I think you've got to make the ask. You've got to show a conviction and a vested interest in the client's business. You've got to show curiosity. You've got to challenge, not be afraid to provoke and ask why and what about this. And obviously, clients don't open the trust door immediately, right? Sure. That sure. Once you've built credibility and built trust both behind your organization and on the back of your own efforts, clients will share. I find they want to share strategic plans. And if the client you're working with doesn't really know, because let's face it, you know, not everybody is the senior person, if you will, then it's about making the ask through them or taking the journey with them to go higher up and get a feel for the direction the business is taking and how research is going to fuel that. But if you're not showing that engagement like it's your own business, you're probably not going to get the commercial insight you need as a result.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sure many data analytics and data science leaders would agree with what you're expressing there, that it can be too easy for people being asked to do the technical work to be expected to be divorced from context when they really need that commercial context, and sharing with them pays back in dividends. Let's get to the heart of it then. I guess an aspect of that is the assumption that there's benefit to firms in doing market research. And the focus I've had on this podcast, people hearing me interview so many data analytics and data science leaders, people could be forgiven, because I think a lot of material out there on social media would make you think it's true, to think, oh, it's all about the data and analytics work now. Research is so passe, it's, you know, it's had its day. I don't believe that, but sell it to me, Aaron. What's the need for market research still these days?
Yes, it hurts my feelings when I hear that, but I'm in your camp, Paul. I mean, no doubt the advances in technology, in software, in data sciences, in predictive algorithms, you name it, they're amazing and they're revolutionizing our sector. And they're great, in my view, currently at, you know, the forecasting, the prediction, the big data consolidation, super, super powerful. But there's still a very clear need, in my view, for market research. The voice of the consumer, the texture and the why that underpins the data, still to this day, in my view, is only really harnessed and understood through primary market research. The emotion that and the implicitly held beliefs and associations that drive brand choice, those things are explored and enlightened through market research, whether it's quantitative or qualitative at mass scale or focused one-on-ones and IDIs. You need these tools in the kit. Further, there's a place for market research in any innovation continuum or creative development continuum to check yourself along the way, to validate the approaches you're taking, to further strengthen and optimize those routes so that ultimately you're increasing your chance of success when you get to the end of that journey.
That makes sense. Good point. And I think the elevator pitch quick summary for many leaders is often explaining to other senior leaders that they need to focus on the why, not just the what of behavior. I'm interested in your reference to, it's also all this innovation in technology has transformed your sector, has transformed the work that's done in market research as well. So I go back a long time with market research, long enough to remember all the focus groups and interviews and omnibus surveys and all that good stuff, even ethnographic work. What's changed? What's different these days? What does innovation in market research mean, Aaron?
I think depending on the firm, you know, that you exist in, the answer to that question can vary. I find there's a spectrum out there these days, ranging from the fully DIY, you know, automated tools, to the high-end consultancies and the McKinseys of the world. And then there's all that area in between. And, you know, for my firm, for Metrics Lab, we sit, and my beliefs sit in the middle of that spectrum where you need a blend of what we'll call machine intelligence. And that is what's changing about market research, the ability to use things like artificial intelligence and different forms of machine learning and automation to do more with data, to do it more quickly. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a need for human intelligence. And so while we're using AI, for instance, to create survey lists and respondent list research, leveraging predictive algorithms built on a massive database of traditional market research, there's still things that machines can't do perfectly, like emotion. And so we need to blend human analysis and human ingenuity on top of what machines can do for that right mix. And so that's how I see the space changing.
Okay, that makes sense. And with the work that you do at Metrics Lab, are you making much use of things we hear about, like gamification and the use of mobile when doing research, or is it the AI helps you with the recruitment and selection, but it's much more of a traditional approach as to how you capture the research?
No, you're spot on, Paul. You know, what we call device agnostic is, it's almost, it's table stakes, frankly, these days. The technology embedded in a survey platform, if you like, to know what device, what platform you're engaging in, and to automatically manipulate, modify the survey environment to fit the platform or the device. Gamification is very important as well. Drag and drops and pictures and sliders and system one inspired techniques, things that are timed or things that maybe allow you to put yourself in the place of an avatar and project. These are all things that we build into our approach to gather richer consumer insight and make sure that consumers are engaged while they're doing it. We know the old saying, right? Garbage in, garbage out. So that is, those aspects are really, really important.
That makes good sense. You referenced a system one. I can't let it pass. I'm going to grab it. I should have expected it from you as a psychologist, but I'm assuming you're meaning the system one and system two that Daniel Kahneman refers to in Thinking Fast and Slow. It sparks in my head the critics that you've had, I've known for many a year, who that whole innovation in behavioral economics almost became a stick to beat market research people with. We now know you can't trust self-report, people are irrational, let's just do behavioral analytics because what people say doesn't reflect what they'll do. How do you answer that? What's the role of market research still in a world that's become convinced by behavioral economics?
Yes, it's a challenge, admittedly. I'll be honest about it. System one, by definition, means no question, no survey question, right? It's a behavior, it's a feeling, it's a deeper emotion or psychology. So the moment you try and elicit that through a line of questioning, it's not truly system one. So we're very open in the sense that we use system one inspired techniques, the operative word being inspired, to bring greater implicit sort of meaning to what is often the system two highly structured survey data. We find that when put together into a story and used the right way, the combination of system one inspired and system two are very potent. So A, there's the storytelling aspect, but B, then there's, holding ourselves accountable. If we're bringing system one inspired techniques and data, if you will, to the story, then we need to validate that as we move forward. And that's about engaging with the client, understanding the decisions that were made with the work we provided, understanding what happened in market, and then relating it all full circle. Say, was this helpful? Did it generate a deeper level of insight that was applied in an effective way to the business?
Yes. Good point. And that triangulation of evidence can be so powerful. I mentioned in the introduction my earlier conversation way back in episode 5 when I was a young man, I interviewing Elspeth. Her role is, or was at least at the time, leading an in-house research team, like many insight leaders who I know. I'm interested, sitting over in the agency side, what do you see as the benefits of in-house research teams to organizations? Or are you disappointed when they exist because you'd rather companies just outsource the whole thing to you?
That's easy. Give it all to us. That'd be amazing. In all seriousness, though, if I think about it, every organization, brand organization, we work with, has an in-house market research team. They take different forms and functions and different sizes, but there's a team who's in charge of, the insight function. Yeah. I think that it really comes down to the organization's expectation and strategy regarding its market research or its insights capability and function. The organizations we work with have to ask themselves, have I properly weighed the strategic priority and the risk of whatever initiative we're pursuing and the research that's going to be required to fuel it with my capability? So is it we can do this on our own because it's low risk sort of situation? Or is it, we could use a bit of a blend and assisted serve model, of which we play there in some respects. It is not the core of our model. Or, hey, this is too big and too important to go on our own. We need you to do it for us or with us. And that's really the space we play. I think historically I've seen the in-house market research functions not doing so much primary research, Paul, but more so the secondary and the desk research and the consolidation of all the body of work that the organization has done, the step back, if you will, and what are those meta learnings? And that's a really important role and a role that we want to play in the way that we partner with our brands and clients as well. But that is changing. The space is changing, right? In-house research firms are being pushed into the primary research space because of the proliferance of DIY tools. And in my view, sometimes that's done really well. And in other times, unfortunately, research best practice suffers.
That's a very, very honest answer. I'm reminded, actually talking to you, and I'm going to do an element of poacher to and gamekeeper here, that in the past with research teams I've led and with clients I've worked with, I've often needed to encourage in-house research teams to be a bit more front of house, as I'd put it. You know, they've sometimes been seen internally just as buyers, and they let the agencies come in and do all the presenting. And I think an organization can end up thinking, quite what value does the in-house research team play? Whereas actually, I know that behind the scenes, they add so much value in making sure that the agency clearly understands the problem and that what's presented back is really relevant insight, because they have that grounding and understanding the organization, but that they need to get more confident at putting themselves forward. So let me turn that round, for which is why I said poacher turn gamekeeper. You're sitting there on the agency side, I'm sure sometimes being brought in or managed by an in-house research team. How would you be advising, if they were completely open to you, how would you be advising in-house teams to best work with you? What's the best way that relationship should operate?
You know, I've never thought about that. If I go back a couple of decades in my career, at least, it really was a model of, hey, come in and do this for us, present it for us. I think to your point, Paul, over time, it does marginalize an insights function. Yeah. And in today's world where, hey, let's face it, data still is, you know, the new oil, and it will be. There's such potential for the in-house research team to bring value to the business table that they need. If I were in their shoes, I would be chasing that day in and day out and looking for those opportunities to be at the table and have a point of view backed up by empirical evidence and great research insight. So as an agency, my view is that we should be supporting our client partners in that very endeavor. Frankly, I want them to be the star. Our credibility will come through in the way that we help them shine. And one of the ways we can do that, especially with, you know, the earlier stage, younger and newer market research managers, is to ask the provocative questions and to challenge a bit more on the brief and to stretch to thinking about the business context and why we are doing this and how it could be applied and who the decision makers are. And if those answers aren't readily available, as I mentioned earlier, encouraging and trying to take that journey with them so that when we do get to the presentation table, if you know what I mean, we present in exactly that way. And the business says, this is exactly why we need this function. Job well done. That's what we endeavor to do. Make our clients shine.
That's a really good way to put it. Your sales background shines through, Aaron. And I mean that in a very positive way. I think the best agencies I've worked with over the years, they are people who value a longer term relationship and are absolutely willing to challenge your thinking and help you think through things better. So sounds good. I don't want to go on too much further without noticing your role. I notice you've, and I think this came up when we talked briefly before, very recently been promoted to President and MD of Metrics Lab in North America. So first, congratulations, Aaron. Have you found that transition, especially during lockdown? It must have been a difficult time to take on an even more senior role.
Yeah, that's fair. As I look back on it, it is quite a unprecedented time to make a move like this. I've been in the post now for 4 whopping months. and I feel, you know, the transition can be looked at 2 ways. My predecessor and I had what I feel is a pretty solid transition plan. Mm-hmm. We had been preparing for the official switchover for some months. Mm-hmm. And so I felt good about the checklist items, you know, the duties and the meetings and the expectations, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You can be prepared as best you can in that regard. Mm-hmm. The flip side is, speaking for myself, when you're taking on a new challenge, a sizably different and meaningful challenge, mm-hmm. you just simply can't be prepared for everything, right? You are going to have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable because that's where the growth occurs, right? And you have to not be afraid to fail and learn from that. So in that regard, you know, am I out ahead of my skis at some moments? Yeah, I may feel that way. But that's, again, where I'm supposed to be. I'd argue if you're not feeling uncomfortable every now and then or day in and day out, you're probably more or less standing still. Mm-hmm. I do think from a lockdown perspective, Paul, yes, it's being in this virtual world, it's changed our business. It will change most businesses forever, I believe, in the sense that we've seen the ways that we can continue to do business in an effective way, to do it virtually, to cut down on some travel, to cut down on some expenses, frankly, and maybe even some physical locations, but not lose too much connectivity or productivity with clients. Mm. Now, that said, the flip side is that we as a business are certainly feeling the need to reconnect. While the virtual experience is leading to some great ideas and more flexible work from home policies and how to stay connected in a digital virtual world, you know, there are segments within our business, particularly our, you know, our younger generation of employees who they need it. They want it. The social, physical, live connection. And we as a business are starting to really feel the lack of it. So all that's to say, when markets reach a threshold where we feel that it's a safe environment, will still probably be an optional environment for a long time, we're going to get back to it. We're going to bring ourselves together because there are some things you have to have: mentorship, training, management, building rapport. Some of these things just are better done in person, and we haven't lost sight of that.
Yeah, that makes good sense there. And I agree. I think I'm hearing the same from other leaders. It's almost like there's been a shape to the curve of, excusing the pun, I suppose, of how organizations have evolved during this lockdown. There was all the initial fear to some extent. There was to some extent a stage where many organizations had the surprise at how quickly and how well they sort of had adapted. Then maybe a little bit of uninformed optimism as that's it, we're going to be like this forever. And I think we are beginning to see now maturing into more organizations going, actually, maybe this isn't quite as perfect as we thought it was. There's nuance here. There's ways we need to flex some of the old model, some of the new model. There's a blend that works best. And I suspect that's some of what you're wrestling with. I'm interested also to think of digging into, because I think this is relevant for leaders who listen to this podcast beyond those who focus on market research and customer insight. The transition to acting at an executive level, what have you needed to change? I remember many years ago, and I think I've still got a book with you for it on the blog, reading a book called The Leadership Pipeline that is all about recognizing that when you make a change to operating at a different level, like managing managers for the first time and then functional leadership and executive leadership, you aren't just gathering new skills, you're kind of letting go of old skills as well. You can't, what got you there won't take you to where you need to go next. I wonder for you, has that been something you're finding to be an experience, that there are things you need to let go of? There's ways you need to change the way you're a leader to operate at your new level?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in my posts prior to this one, there's always a level of responsibility and accountability with any job at any level. Certainly, the mindset shift of prior, you know, was I'm going to have to contribute meaningfully to an important decision, to now, which is I'm going to have to make an important decision, has been quite an experience to reframe my thinking there. But letting go of details is definitely a work in progress. And I think for me, at least, the way that what I focus on to allow myself to do that is our strategic operating plan. Okay. I can't speak for every firm and how they're managed, but in my current post, you know, the creation of this business plan that gives direction to, you know, the opportunities in the market, the solutions we want to innovate and renovate to hit those hot spots, the verticals of importance, the internal units, whether it's marketing or product innovation or commercial or research or platforms, all of these facets that are going to drive our business are captured in our plan. And we stay, I and my US leadership team, stay very close to this plan, checking in on it quarterly. Are we where we want to be? Why or why not? What do we need to do about that? And this process keeps me at a 30,000 foot level, at a much more strategic level. And it doesn't allow me to get into the weeds because I'm looking at these gears in our driving machine, if you will. And that's where I'm playing. And that's where my US leadership team is playing. And it requires a lot of trust and capability from those that surround you on a leadership team to make sure that they are working down through the levels for those people who do attend to the finer details.
That makes sense, though, and thank you for sharing that. And recognize completely from my own experience and from those I've worked with, I think almost most, I wouldn't just say some, I'd say most technical leaders who've risen up through the ranks from actually delivering really well, being a really effective technical leader even for their function, it's a challenge shifting to a wider remit. And as you say, stepping away from the detail, not becoming a micromanager, as the old term goes. I hear what you're saying about the longer term strategic plan. It's kind of interesting in a way, because I'm hearing that as you're still giving yourself some detail to focus on. It's just long-term detail rather than short-term detail. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. Defining long-term is tricky, right? Because this space is changing very quickly. So, you know, we look at a 1 to 2 year plan, and we have to always be asking ourselves, you know, what are we hearing from our clients? What are we seeing in the market? And are we taking the time to investigate and try and understand, you know, to use a hockey analogy, where the puck is going, not where it is now. Yeah. And if you're not doing that, you probably won't be crisp or see what's out there in the next 1 to 2 years.
That makes good sense. Anything else beyond that strategic focus then, accepting, I think you're very pragmatic about the time period. Anything else that's helped you avoid micromanaging your previous peers maybe, or your leadership team or managers in the organization, helped you step away and empower others to be trusted, as you put it, to do the detail?
I don't know that I'll answer your question perfectly, but what comes to mind for me is the other areas that I'm forced to focus on now that keep me out of the micromanagement. As I mentioned earlier, I really think a lot of that comes down to the selection of the lieutenants, if you will, the key people in a leadership team and the roles they fulfill, and ensuring that those roles are A, essential to the business, B, very discreet, right? That they're not redundant. So you get the most out of your people, the most efficiency. And if you have that, and it's not easy, but I think we've done a good job of selecting people who are great commercial leaders, who are great research leaders, operations leaders, key account and global strategy leaders, finance leaders.
And with
all that in a team, you can be very potent. But for me these days, you know, maybe this is a no-brainer. I'm only in the post 4 months, but I find myself a lot more focusing on the balance of top line momentum and growth weighed against internal efficiencies and profitability and driving shareholder value. And decision-making is another thing I'm working on. How to know that you've taken in enough information or all you're going to get, make a decision quickly, because there's not a lot of time these days. They keep coming at you and you have to move on. Understanding sometimes you'll make the right one and sometimes you may not make the right one, but there's value in both of those scenarios. And at the end of the day, the biggest insight I think I'm having these days is that you are not going to make everyone happy. It's virtually impossible. If you strive for that, you probably will never make a decision. All these things, Paul, point being, they keep me out of the micromanagement weeds, if that makes sense.
It does, Aaron, and I agree with you completely. It's an emotional lesson, I think, particularly for people who have been used to excelling and to some extent pleasing their internal clients. The step to that broader responsibility across the whole organization is a real step away from being able to please people. You really face full on into, you will have constituents who you will disappoint. There will be losses in order to achieve change. And that's, you're right to identify that, I think. Any other skills you'd highlight for any other listeners who might be similarly moving from a more technical leadership role to a wider leadership brief? What skills are you focusing on developing to get even better at your role?
I mean, it sounds cliche to say leadership, but really, in my view, those are the skill sets. And frankly, I maybe should spend more time with you, Paul, in terms of executive leadership, keeping an eye on where the company needs to go. The fact that there are internal stakeholders and internal reliances and employees who depend on this job for their well-being and for their family's well-being. There are shareholders to expect a return. How to lead a business in a way that tends to both of those dimensions, being confident, being transparent to a great degree so that everyone knows what is going on, where we're heading, what our odds of success are, or what's going to be required to get there. That's a new area for me, but something that I find very, very important. If you don't mind, I would pivot a little bit on that question in the sense of, I thought maybe where you would go is, you know, what advice might you have for people in market research, or maybe if you're new to the business? And, you know, that's something I think about a lot these days as I watch the way the space is changing.
Good.
I would say, you know, if you're new in the business, an appreciation, back to your earlier comments around data and analytics, an appreciation for what I call information technology, not IT in the traditional sense, but data sciences, understanding and appreciating the vast types of data that are out there and how they're generated, how they're harnessed, how they're consolidated, and the tools and the technologies that can turn data into information. And as we move forward, turning that information into real insight, that's still a human job, but I think as tools get smarter, we're going to bleed into machines being able to do that. Understanding the power in that sphere, I think will pay great dividends for a market researcher moving forward. But from a softer side, Paul, I would just say storytelling. And again, that probably sounds cliche, but the ability to step back from the detail and to put findings in a storied, engaging way that's done through a business context. is such an important soft skill, one that requires training. It requires mentorship. If you know someone in your business or in your sphere of influence who is good at these things, get close to them. Learn that skill, because clients really appreciate it, and the work you do will stick if you're good at that.
Completely agree, Aaron. Thank you for pivoting, a really good pivot. So thank you for both of what you shared. I agree wholeheartedly that I think not only would market researchers really benefit from understanding the diversity and capability of data analytics and data science roles and what's possible with the raw materials of data, but I equally encourage data science professionals and those on the analytics side to understand what market research and customer insight can offer as well. I think the collaboration between the two is an immensely fertile area. And agree with you on storytelling. In fact, I'm struck that a number of elements during our conversation have continued as themes. Often it's been a reference to stepping back and the big picture and the human element and thinking about what the story and the narrative is here. Maybe even though it is an overused term, maybe the role that most has a right to talk about being storytellers would be market research professionals. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I also think that, you know, not to sound so cliche again, but I find it still to be true that the way you present things and how you say things often can be as important, or I dare to say more important, but as important as what you are saying, what information you are conveying. And, you know, asking ourselves, what's the emotional objective of what you want to deliver, not just the information objective. Are we trying to persuade, excite, bring fear and doubt? These things are incredibly important in how we engage and bring engagement from the audiences we're delivering to. And I encourage anyone to take what is probably analogous to acting lessons, to think about those ways to present and engage in storytell that are beyond just the words that come out of one's mouth, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. I can't remember who it was I interviewed, but I think there's another leader I've interviewed recently who referenced improv classes and how effective they can be. And I agree with you completely, Aaron. Well, let's build on that then. Given that diversity of skills and the capabilities that you're thinking about and how your own role has changed as well, I always close off these conversations with leaders asking them what they've changed their mind on. And I'm doing that for a deliberate reason, to broadcast the message, if you like, that even successful leaders like yourself who've reached the heights of president or intergalactic leader or whatever it is, are still not finished articles. We're all growing and learning as leaders. So, Aaron, for you, what have you changed your mind on in recent years?
I'm not going to take an academic or a sort of tactical approach to that one, but I'll go with my gut, Paul, and what really boils up for me when you ask me what's changed. I think the best way to put it is my view of difficulty, or how I handle difficulty. I think in years past, and this actually holds true in a business context, in a personal context, or just a full life blending of both of those worlds. You know, difficulty, challenges, obstacles, they were exactly that in years past. They were painful. They frustrated me. They annoyed me. They drew off of my positive mojo. They exhausted me. And these days, I've completely reframed that. Maybe out of necessity, but I think it's, you know, it's just a maturity one grows into. That difficulty can be celebrated. It can almost be, it's not like I want to invite it, but you know it when you encounter it. And I feel like it's an opportunity to grow and to learn something about yourself. I recently read someone say, pressure is a privilege. And I sat on that for a while. And I've come to really believe it. Pressure makes you feel like, you know, you have an opportunity to deliver something of value, to do something meaningful, particularly in a business context, whether it's for your clients, your employees, or your shareholders, or yourself. So I invite it these days and I celebrate it. And that's really been a game changer for me in the way that I'm, you know, trying to and expecting to manage this business or any other business in the future.
That makes good sense. And thank you for sharing that. It's funny, in one of your previous answers, when we were talking about how you'd evolved and were evolving as a leader, I was almost tempted to reference a book, and I'm going to now because you reminded me of it again. I recently did a book review on the blog for a book called The Practice of Adaptive Leadership. And it so talks into this topic that you're raising that I think to be leaders who are capable of driving adaptive change and leading people through adaptive change in their organizations, there is a need to become comfortable with difficulty, to be able to orchestrate conflict, to be able to not know for sure what's going to happen. And I think you're right to highlight it. There is a emotional maturity, I think was almost the way you phrased it, in that journey. And it can be so profitable for leaders, even if it's an uncomfortable journey.
I have this knack, Paul, to recast what I tried to articulate, but in a much more articulate way.
you're too kind, Aaron. You're full of rich prompts to my thoughts. I'm just maybe more verbose. Anyway, it has been great to talk to you, as I thought it would be. Thanks for your time today, Aaron. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Absolute delight for me too, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up, and I will endeavor to continue to hunt down good research customer insight leaders to have that voice in the conversation as well. But there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader, alloneword.com, so you might want to check that out too. Before then, thanks everyone for your time. Have a great week, stay safe, and enjoy your leadership journey. Even if it is taking you into some challenges, you can do it. Bye for now.